And close your eyes. And one of the first things to do as you close your eyes is just to start off with feeling your body, making sure, first of all, that you are comfortable. The beginning of the meditation is always the time to adjust yourself. It's only going to be about half an hour, but still, it's important to be comfortable for that half an hour. And once your body is feeling quite nice, the next thing to do is always to check if you have any tensions in your body. Remember, the purpose here of meditation practice is always to feel at ease and to feel relaxed. So first thing is just to feel that your body is feeling nice. And if you feel that you have any tensions, maybe as a consequence of work or of stress or of family or whatever it is to release that tension from your stomach, from your shoulders, wherever it might be. But take a few deep breaths and just allow the tension to dissipate as you breathe out. And just stay with the body for now. The body is a great thing to contemplate as you start off your meditation. It gives you a sense of focus right away. So keep on feeling the body, relaxing the body. And again, if you feel any tension or tightness or pain anywhere, please release that. Don't do anything before you feel 100% relaxed and at ease. And just continue feeling the body all the way from the bottom to the top, being aware of everything. And as you feel the body, wherever you feel anything isn't 100% right, just place your attention there, a very gentle, very kind attention. And as you place the attention there, it's as if you're allowing yourself to be more peaceful, more at ease, more relaxed. And say to yourself, say to your body, thank you, body, for all your services of all these years. Now I will look after you instead. In this way, you bring up a sense of metta, a sense of compassion towards yourself and towards your body. And the purpose of the meditation at this point is to bring the body to a state of relaxation that is deeper than you normally can feel. And it's not just about the body. Remember, it is the mind that controls the body. So if the body isn't relaxed, it means the mind isn't relaxed either. So by relaxing the body, you're also relaxing the mind at the same time. So take that relaxation one step deeper than you have ever done before. Remember the attitude of kindness, the attitude of ease, the attitude of compassion. And just feel that beautiful sense of ease, the beautiful sense of relaxation as the body becomes more relaxed than it normally is. And just feel that. This is one of the first benefits of meditation practice, when the body becomes really nice and relaxed. And it feels good to be inside of your body here. It feels nice. Often it is painful. Now for once it feels at ease. And you will notice that what happens at this stage is that the body fades into the background. The present moment starts to become beautiful. And because the present moment is beautiful, mindfulness begins to arise all by itself. So just notice that. And just by noticing that, you're starting to understand how the process of meditation works. And as the mind settles down into the present moment, and it settles down because the present moment is pleasant, as you do that, just remind yourself, this is not the time to do anything. This is the time to be a passive observer, to allow the world, to allow the sounds, to allow the thoughts in your mind, just to allow everything to go on by itself. This is the time not to judge. This is the time when things are neither right nor wrong. And all you have to do is just sit back and be at peace, enjoy the peace of the present moment. And again, try to see the happiness, try to see the pleasure in not having to do anything at all. There's nothing to do, there's no action you have to take. All you have to do is to be. All you have to do is to exist right here, right now. And just feel that. Inspire yourself. All those burdens of ordinary life have been put aside. Today there is no work. Right now there is no family, there is no house. There is nothing you have to do except just sitting quietly and peacefully. Oh, how beautiful that is. And as you are aware of the present moment, you will notice that one of the things that exists in that present moment is the breath. And when the breath comes to you, never search for the breath, always wait for the breath to come to you. When the breath arises in your mind, and very gently, no force, no willpower, nothing at all, just very gently, rest your attention on your breathing. And as you just allow the breath, very gently to rest on your breathing, and you allow that process to go on all by itself. coming towards the end of the meditation. And before we do that, I would like you first of all to just reflect for a few moments how fortunate you are, how fortunate each one of us is to be in the company of so many good people. In a hall like this today, you find people with so much kindness, so much goodness, so much generosity, so much compassion and peace in their hearts. And what a wonderful thing it is to have Kalyanamitas like this on the path. Thank you, each one of you. Thank you for being my spiritual friend. Thank you for practicing together with me. May each one of you, may you be happy. May you be well. And then, before we come to the end, ask yourself how you feel. How do you feel right now? Do you feel more at ease? Do you feel more relaxed than you did when you started? And if you do feel more at ease, if you do feel more relaxed, if you feel better, ask yourself why. What is it that had brought into existence, the present state of your mind? What perception have you given rise to? What things have you let go of? And as you start to watch your meditation in this way, as you start to understand the process, you start to take charge of your own meditation. And this is how you become proficient in this practice. So just reflect on this for a few moments before we come to the end. Okay, so that's the end of the meditation. So please come out and we can continue with the program. Okay, so I hope you enjoyed that. It's always nice to do a little bit of meditation before we start the Dhamma talk, just to feel a bit more peaceful and a bit more at ease. And as I said before, it's so nice to come to a place. This in Australia would just be like an ordinary Wednesday morning. And then you come here and you see so many people, right? I don't know how many people is here today, but so many people wearing white, coming to a place to do meditation practice and to do something good rather than to do all the things that people ordinarily do in the world. And what a wonderful thing that is, that people come together in this way to do something positive, right? Something uplifting, something inspiring in the world, keeping the precepts, doing acts of kindness and generosity, trying to think about the Dhamma. How can we lift ourselves up? And in the process of lifting ourselves up, we're also helping to lift other people up, and in effect, lifting up society as a whole. What a powerful thing that is. I often think about the kind of things that we ordinarily hear about the world. You know, when you watch TV, you see the news. Sometimes you wonder whether we should really watch the news, right? It's just all so bad. All the things you see are so terrible, and things are doing bad. People are doing bad things around the world. And how depressing that can be sometimes. And sometimes we need to remember that actually the world isn't like that. The world is full of individuals who do acts of kindness, acts of generosity, who do good things to each other every day of their life. And this is what we're seeing here today. And this is what I see as a monk when I stay in Perth or I travel around the world. I see all these beautiful people everywhere. And I wonder whether the news you see on TV, does that reflect reality? Or is the reality what I see in my ordinary life? And I realize the things I see in my ordinary life are much closer to reality than all those things in the world you can see in the news or whatever. So remember that. It's so important that we remember the goodness and the kindness and the people around us. And when we remember that goodness and kindness, it lifts that up. It gives us a sense of ease and having metta towards the people who are there, having a sense of compassion and understanding. And then just that much, it's actually enough to build a better world already. But what I want to talk about today, I was going to talk a little bit about meditation practice and how specifically to use meditation in ordinary life, in your daily life, to help you on your spiritual path. And it's going to be some of the same themes I was just talking about just now during the meditation itself. And there are some remarkable things about meditation. And, of course, where do we find this information about meditation in the first place? And when I want to find out about meditation practice, the place that I go and to find inspiration, of course, are to some of the great meditation teachers that exist in the contemporary world. Of course, you use those. You use your own experience to some extent, however far that is, to learn from that. But in the end, there is one source for understanding meditation that is more important than anything else. And that, of course, is the word of the Buddha. It's the word of the Buddha that is what is the final standard, the gold standard in our world for what meditation is all about. So what do you find when you read the word of the Buddha? What do you find? What does it say about meditation? And there's a number of things that it says about meditation. But one of the most powerful things to me that it always says, and you see this again and again and again, right? If you see something in the suttas, I have read the suttas quite widely. When you see something again and again and again in the suttas, what does that mean? It means that the Buddha would have spoken this to different audiences across India, different time, different place, to monastics, to lay people. And the fact that he speaks about this again and again and again means it is one of the important teachings of the Buddha. That's what it means, right? So what does he say here? And one of the things that he says about meditation, which is so powerful to me and so beautiful, that it always has to do with happiness. Always has to do with joy. Always has to do with gladness. Always has to do with a sense of ease and feeling good about yourself. That is one of the most powerful and important characteristics of meditation practice. And you will see when the Buddha talks about how meditation comes into being, how you're supposed to experience meditation, he always starts off by saying it begins with sila. Sila, right? What is sila? Maybe we can talk about that more afterwards. Sila is often translated into English as morality or virtue. I don't know if that is a full justice for the word sila. It is actually more than that. But anyway, it begins with sila. Then based on sila, you have what is called in Pali pamuja. Pamuja means joy or gladness. Based on pamuja, you have piti. Piti, again, rapture or joy. Based on that, you have pasadi. Pasadi means tranquility, right? When everything becomes incredibly peaceful. When it's so peaceful that you don't want to get up from your seat anymore and you just want to meditate for the rest of your life. You don't want to do anything else. Have you ever had that experience? You just said, wow, this is so nice, right? I'm sure many of you will know what I'm talking about. When you really feel so nice, you never want to get up again. You never want to have anything to do with work, or with all that kind of stuff. All you want to do is just be peaceful. That's pasadi. And that's only the beginning, right? It goes much deeper than that. Then from that comes sukha, deep sense of happiness. And from that comes samadhi. Samadhi, the full stilling of the mind, when the mind becomes incredibly powerfully peaceful. And what you will notice, that throughout this whole sequence I have been talking about, it's all about happiness, right? Pamuja, piti, pasadi, sukha, and then eventually samadhi. Everything is about happiness. The whole process that you're supposed to experience in this meditation is about happiness. And it's incredibly powerful teaching, and it is a very, very useful guideline. Even if our own meditation isn't that profound, even if you feel that you have a long way to go to feel these very powerful states, it is still a very, very useful guideline for how to go about with the meditation practice. So that is number one, happiness. Number two, and this is from the same kind of sutta, is the Buddha says, na cetanaya karaniya. I apologize for my pronunciation, it's probably not the best, but this is how we pronounce things in the West. So na cetanaya karaniya, not to be done by the will, not to be done by force, not to be done by activity, right? This process of meditation is not to be done by willing it into existence. It's not the force of the mind, the force of your personality, the force of, you know, using willpower, using your kind of your drive, all the things that we use in ordinary life to get us somewhere, right? You go to school, you study hard, you have to use your willpower to get somewhere. Then you have a career, then you do all the things that a career is supposed to do to you. You use willpower to get there. Meditation is the exact opposite. No willpower. In fact, willpower gets in the way. It specifically says, na cetanaya karaniya, not to be done by willpower. So all you have to do, what that means, is that all you have to do is just to sit back and relax, right? There's nothing you can do to force this path to move forward. All you have to do is put the foundation into place. And when the foundation is in place, it's supposed to happen by itself. So you do what is right at the beginning. And when you have done what is right at the beginning, the next thing you have to do is just to relax, right? It's another beautiful message. It's beautiful because it means that it is so easy, it is so enjoyable, it is so relaxing. No force is required to make this whole thing work. So remember that. Remember this, another very important aspect of meditation. Really all you have to do is just to relax and enjoy yourself. So that is the second point, right? It's all about happiness. It's not to be done by willpower. If any of you are interested in the references to the Pali Canon for these things, you are more than welcome to ask me, because I can show you where these things are found in case you want to look it up for yourself, which is always advisable, right? Can you really trust me? I'm just sitting here talking. I could say all kind of nonsense, right? You have no idea whether I'm telling the truth or what I'm saying. Maybe I've misread. Maybe I'm misinterpreting. maybe even though I'm an honest monk, I just don't understand what's going on. This is always a possibility. And for that reason, it is often good to check it out for yourself and see what you feel. And the last thing that I was going to talk about this morning, which I think is so important in this whole process, if it is true that willpower does not work, if it is true that all you have to do is to relax, and then the whole process happens by itself, one condition leading to another result, that result being the condition for a deeper result, moving forwards all by itself. If it is a natural process, what does that mean? And what it means is that the first thing, the base thing at the bottom, the very first thing in this process is incredibly important. Because it is that, if you put the basic foundation into place, it is only then that this whole thing happens as a process by itself. Right? What is that foundation? I just mentioned it before. It's sila. Sila is the foundation. So if your meditation is not taking off, if when you sit back and you're just relaxing, you don't feel the joy, you don't feel the peace, you don't feel the happiness, then what is it that you have to do? You have to go back and ask yourself, can I improve my sila even more? That is the question we should always ask ourselves. That is the question I ask myself. I sit down to meditate and I think, my meditation isn't as good as I would like it to be. I would like it to be much deeper than this, right? So what is it that I'm doing which isn't right? And when I reflect, I can look into myself and I can see some defilements. I can see some silly thinking, right? Stupid way of thinking. Sometimes I can maybe see that I even say something which wasn't quite right, right? And then I understand why my meditation isn't being more profound than it is. I'm sure that everyone here is very, very good. Everybody here are very good people. But there's always, no matter how good you are, no matter how well you are practicing already, still there's usually more that can be done. There's more that we can actually do. I'll get back to the idea of sila in a second and describe it in a bit more detail. But before I do that, I want to talk about two different aspects of how meditation works. What we need to do to make our meditation function. There's two things. And the first thing is what we need to do right now, right? You sit down, you want to meditate. What is the immediate cause right now for meditation to work? That is the one thing. And the second thing is like, what is the distant cause? The cause that we have to cultivate every day, all the time, to make meditation function. And that, of course, is sila, and I will talk more about that in a second. But before I talk about that, let me first talk a little bit more about the immediate cause for meditation. Now, to understand the immediate cause for meditation, we can go back to the first two things I was talking about. Happiness and no doing, no willpower, right? Just relaxing and enjoying the present moment. And remember, the first teaching of the Buddha, the very first thing that he mentioned in the very first discourse, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, what is the very first thing that he says? Majjhima Patipada, right? Middle way, Majjhima Patipada. Now that Majjhima Patipada is, of course, on the one hand, not to indulge too much in sensual pleasures, right? And, of course, when you're meditating, you're not indulging. So during the meditation, that's fine. But the other side of the Majjhima Patipada is not to torture yourself, right? The Atta Kilamatanu Yoga. Atta Kilamatanu Yoga means torturing the body. It means creating pain in the body. Just like the Indians did in those days. I'm not sure if anybody in Sri Lanka does that, but today you go to India, you still see people doing Atta Kilamatanu Yoga, like standing on one leg for 10 years and these kind of things. And this, we're not supposed to do that. And the amazing thing is, you go around the Buddhist world and you meet Buddhist practitioners, you meet Buddhist teachers, and that is often exactly what they do. They do Atta Kilamatanu Yoga. They say, sit for 1.5 hours, don't change your posture. If it gets very painful, just watch the pain, right? And do that for, 10 hours a day or whatever. But be very careful with that sort of thing. Be very careful, because this, as far as I can see, this is actually going against the Buddha's very first advice in the very first sutta that he spoke to his first five disciples, right? Do not find the middle way. Find the way where there is, you're not actually producing, you're not actually making more pain than is necessary. Life is difficult enough as it is, right? Is there anyone here who has a life which is too easy? It's hard to imagine anyone has a life which is too easy. Life is never too easy. We come to Buddhism because Buddhism promises you the alleviating of suffering and the arising of happiness. We shouldn't search out more suffering in the Buddhist teachings. And yet that is sometimes what happens in meditation practice. People push themselves too much. There's too much pain as part of the meditation practice. Please don't do that. Of course, sometimes there will be a little bit of pain, and that's okay. But do not allow pain to become something which is so kind of almost ingrained into the meditation practice. The purpose of meditation is always to feel at ease, to feel relaxed, and to enjoy what you're doing. How are you going to persevere? How are you going to be able to continue this beautiful Buddhist path if you feel so much pain? You're not going to be able to do it. And I know a lot of the people who experience so much pain in the meditation, they give up, right? I've had enough. This Buddhism is no good. Had enough of this Buddhist teaching. Okay, I might do a bit of sila and a bit of kindness, but no more meditation. And what a terrible thing that is, because meditation is something which is so profound and so beautiful and has such incredible potential to make us into better people, to experience deep satisfaction and joy in our life. The potential is so great. Please, let us not destroy that potential by grasping the Dhamma in the wrong way and going down the wrong path. And the strange thing is that if you feel too much pain in your body, the problem with that is that you cannot let go of the body, right? You cannot let go, because the pain in the body means that your mind is interested in the body. The mind goes out to the body and cannot let go, because there is a problem to be resolved. It's just the same problem as with indulging in sensual pleasures, right? The pursuit of sensual pleasures. This is why the Buddha talks about the middle way. If we are pursuing sensual pleasures, again, the mind has an interest in the body, right? Because the body gives you pleasure. And the problem is exactly the same thing with pain. If you have too much pain, the mind is also interested in the body, because there is a problem to be resolved in the body. So that's why neither pain nor pleasure in the body is no good. It's no good because it makes it impossible for you to go beyond the body. And this is what I was doing before. You may have noticed while we were doing the meditation just before, I say relax, right? Allow the body to become at ease. No tension, no tension in the stomach, no tension in the shoulders, no pains, no dis-ease in the muscles in your legs, no knee pains, none of that stuff. And when the body becomes very, very relaxed and very at ease, it like almost becomes like a feather, and it almost fades away from your consciousness. The body is no longer important. The body loses its significance, and the body becomes, in a sense, pleasant. And when the body becomes pleasant, the mind comes into the present moment, because it is the happiness, it is the pleasure of being here, which is the glue that draws the mind into the present moment. And then mindfulness becomes possible. Then sati becomes possible. Right? Sati becomes possible because you are feeling happy to be in the present moment. It is very obvious once you understand the mechanism. It is so obvious. Of course it has to be like that. If the present moment is not pleasurable, if it is painful, it is incredibly difficult. It is impossible, really, to stay sustained for a sustained period of time in the present moment. So you can see how the whole thing works, right? You feel, you get away from the pain and the displeasure, sense of happiness and ease arises inside of yourself. Because of the happiness and ease, mindfulness arises. When mindfulness arises, only then is it possible to watch the breath
or to do any other kind of meditation topic. This is the sequence. And be careful with that. Far too many people, when they sit down to meditate, they grasp onto the breath straight away. Oh, I'm going to get that breath right straight away to the breath. That is not the right way to do it, as I understand it. If you read the Anapanasati Sutta of the Buddha, the discourse on the mindfulness of breathing, it always starts off by saying, first of all, before you even begin watching the breath, it says, Satting Upatapetva, having established mindfulness, as the very first thing it says. So always take that time to allow mindfulness to arise before you even start watching the breath. Then you're doing it in accordance with the Buddha's instruction. If you go straight away to the breath, it is too quick and it doesn't work. So please remember that. A few years ago, I was in Singapore. One of the things about being an English-speaking monk is that you are in big demand, so you have to travel so many different places, to Singapore, to everywhere pretty much. And anyway, I was in Singapore giving some talks, just like I'm doing here tonight, I suppose. And I was staying in the flat with this man, and this man, one day he came to me and he said, Bhante, please, can I talk to you? I want to talk to you about meditation practice. And so I said, yes. And then he told me this story that he had been on a retreat. And he said he had felt so much pain everywhere. He had felt so much tension. He had never felt so miserable in his whole life as he had done during these 9 days of that meditation retreat, right? So absolutely miserable. And I said to him that, well, you know, maybe you should try another meditation technique. Try another teacher. Somebody teaches differently. And he said, no. Never again will I meditate. It was such a terrible experience that I'm never going to do this again for the rest of my life. And I thought to myself, wow, what a waste. What a terrible thing. Here is a nice man doing all the right things, and yet he's so turned off by meditation, he never wants to do it again for the rest of his life. So please, please don't make that mistake, because you're going to destroy the potential that the Dhamma has for you. Okay, so that is about the immediate cause for meditation. So this is how, what we need to do, as far as I can see, as we sit down to do any specific meditation. There is more to it as well. There's also about the attitude, to have the right attitude in meditation, a sense of kindness in your heart, a sense of compassion. This is also very important in meditation. But instead of talking about that now, I will move on to what I will call the distant cause for meditation to work. And as I was saying before, one of the only really important cause for meditation to work in the long run is sila. Sila, the sense of being good, of being moral, of being a virtuous person. Sila in the Pali language is much more than morality in English. Sila has to do with our whole personality, our attitudes, our habits of life. All of these things are sila in Pali. It's a very, very broad word, and it includes all of these kind of things. And because it includes all of those things, it means you shouldn't do the bad things, right? Like the pancha sila. But it also means you should do the good things, right? This is the opposite side of the coin. We should avoid doing the bad, but we should also be doing what is good. And also, what sila also includes is the sila of the mind, the sila of how we think about the world, how we perceive things. The mental sila is also a tremendously important thing, according to the Buddha and according to the Pali Suttas. So all of these things we have to take into account in our practice as practicing Buddhists. So please remember that, right? It is very, very broad. It has to do with our whole personality, how we look at things, how we perceive things, how the world, you know, how we deal with everything in life is part of this thing called sila. And one of the basic things about how we act with the world and how we deal with the people around us and how we deal with the world is, of course, the idea of generosity. The idea of generosity is a very, very important part of the Buddhist teaching. And I thought I want to talk just a little bit about that, just to see what the Buddha has to say about this. It is one of those astonishing things that the Buddha actually taught many, many suttas about generosity and about how we should perform this, how we should do this to give maximum benefit for ourselves and also for the people around us. And one of the interesting things the Buddha has to say about generosity, and this is something I mentioned to some other people yesterday, is he was in a conversation with King Pasenadi of Kosala. And King Pasenadi goes to the Buddha and he asks the Buddha, where should a gift be given? Right? So what do you think the Buddha says? Maybe the Buddha says, oh, it should be given to the arahants, or it should be given to the Sangha, or it should be given to, you know, where there is most merit to be had. Do you think that's what he said there? No, what the Buddha said, this is actually very interesting and very powerful, and it says something about how the mind is to be developed. It says something about the Buddha's path. The Buddha said, you should give a gift whenever you feel inspired, wherever you feel a sense of peace, wherever you feel a sense of tranquility and at ease when you give a gift. That is where you should give a gift. Basically, wherever you feel inspired, right? That is where you should give. It's a very profound saying. The next question, and this is the interesting part, because the next question that King Pasenadi asked the Buddha is, where is there most merit, right? And you might think, well, what's the difference between these questions? You know, where should I give a gift and where is the most merit? Is there any difference? Shouldn't I give where there is most merit? How can there be a difference? But this is the interesting point, right? Because when the Buddha is asked, where is the most merit? He says that it is for giving to those people who are arahants in the world. That is where there is the most merit. So how do we reconcile this? Why is there a difference between the place where we should give on the one hand and the place where there is most merit? You think it would be the same thing, but it isn't. And the reason is because giving is not just about merit. There is more to giving than merit. And I was joking yesterday with some of the people I talked this story. And sometimes you find people who have this calculation, right? They calculate, well, if I give to this monk, there's so much merit. If I give to this nun, there's so much merit. But if I give here and if I give these kind of requisites, then it's so much merit. And if I give, you know, so many days a year, and they make this calculation, and then at the end of my life, I will have accumulated so much merit. Is that the right way of gaining merit? If it comes to calculating, right, when you go out into the world and you try to calculate and you try to figure out the way to make the most merit, you are destroying the happiness and joy that comes from natural giving. You just give because it comes from the goodness of your heart. And that is why the Buddha says you should give where you feel inspired. Because when you feel inspired in giving in a certain place, it means that often you feel a sense of joy, right? You feel, wow, I really want to give here. This person is really worthy of my generosity. It doesn't have to be a Buddhist, right? It can be some poor person somewhere. It can be anybody. The Buddha doesn't give any stipulations whatsoever. It can be to an animal. It can be anywhere, as long as you feel inspired in the act of generosity. That is what the Buddha says matters. You feel joy. You feel mindfulness. And later on, when you are going to do the recollection of your generosity, it's called the Chaga Musati in Pali, and you sit down to meditate, that is the act which comes back into your mind. That is the act you will remember, because it was so powerful, because it was so inspiring when you actually gave in that way. So you are learning to give. You're learning about the power of generosity. But if you try to calculate who is the arahant in the world, right? This one, I'm not sure which one. You don't know anyway who the arahants are, right? So you might as well give up. So that is the right way of giving. It's a very powerful teaching here. So feel in your heart, instead of having ideas about where there is the most merit and being calculating about it, feel your heart. What does your heart say? What does your heart say about where you want to give? Where do you feel compassion? Where do you feel a sense of joy in the act of generosity? That is the right place. And then keep on doing that again and again and again, right? It's not often about the size of the gift. It's more about the continuation of generosity, doing it on a regular basis in this way. And then it becomes such a powerful thing on the Buddhist path. And the ideal, what we are trying to reach here, we're trying to reach that state of mind where your heart just opens up, right? I'm sure many of you have experienced that sometimes when your heart opens up and you just want to give to everybody, right? Just, wow, there's no limits anymore. You just want to give of yourself, give and give and give. And then, of course, your heart closes up a little bit again. But sometimes you tap into that powerful feeling inside where you just want to give to the whole world. And that is the kind of feeling we're trying to achieve on the Buddhist path. That is the kind of feeling that leads to deep samadhi. It's a beautiful, beautiful feeling. It's beautiful for yourself. It's beautiful for other people. And it leads you to deep meditation. The Buddha specifically says that in the suttas. Without that openness of the heart, without that willingness to be absolutely generous to everybody, you cannot reach the deep stages of meditation practice. And I would encourage you, please tell each other stories about generosity. Tell each other stories about the kindness of people around you. When you hear those stories, it can be so inspiring to hear what people do in the world, the kind of kindness that people often have. And I am reminded right now of a story that I was heard a long time ago. And this was a girl who was originally from Sri Lanka. She was born in this country, but I think she migrated to Australia. Or maybe she was always in Sri Lanka. I'm not sure. I never met this girl myself, but I knew her auntie who was living in Australia. And she told me this story about this girl. She was in her early 20s or late teens. It's a very quite young girl still. And she had recently bought herself a new dress, right? A beautiful new dress that she was very happy with. And one day, one of her friends came over to her house and she saw this girl wearing this beautiful dress. And she says to her, "Wow, that is a really, really beautiful dress that you're wearing." And so this girl who was wearing this dress, she said, "Wow, if you think it is so beautiful, I will give it to you." So she took off her dress and gave the dress to her friend, right? And what a powerful thing that is. It is the inspiration of the moment, understanding right here, right now, that you have a chance to do an act of kindness. And instead of clinging on, holding on to an object that you have just obtained for yourself, because you understand the power, because you feel inspired, you give up the dress to your friend right there, right then. So this is just an example. So tell each other these stories. When I hear these stories, I feel really inspired. Even though I'm a monk and I can't really give away my robe because that's all I have, then still, it is a beautiful story and it reminds me too of being generous in my life, right? As a monk, I also have lots of opportunities for being generous. The reason I'm sitting here is really because of generosity, right? That's why I sit here, to talk, to share some of my own experience and understanding here. But there was another story, and this happened quite recently in Perth, where I am living. I'm not actually Australian by birth, but I live in Perth with Ajahn Brahm as my teacher. And this was one of the Thai ladies. She was born in Thailand, and she's living in Australia now, but she's still very much Thai, right? Her English isn't all that good and all that sort of thing. And one day she came to the monastery. And she comes very regularly, very strong supporter of our monastery. And she told us this story of what happened to her. And she said that one day she was out shopping. And while she was out shopping, she had parked her car in front of one of these burger, like McDonald's, right? One of these McDonald's, I'm not sure if it was McDonald's, but one of these very simple burger, hamburger restaurants. She had parked her car there, and then she had gone out, and she had gone shopping in the various shops in the local area. And then she was coming back to her car. And when she was coming back to her car, there were all these children there. And these children were running around her car. Some were sitting on top of the car. Some were lying under her car, right? These very naughty children. And then she realized, I can't drive off. The children are lying under the car. If I drive off, I will kill these children, right? And then, in that sort of situation, it's very easy to get a bit upset, right? To get a little bit angry. You naughty children, what are you doing? This is my car. Look, you are making it dirty. You are scratching the paint or whatever. You can't do this kind of thing. Go away. Right? This is kind of the natural thing that many people will do in that kind of situation. But no, she is a Buddhist. She's a very good-hearted person. And what she said to the kids was, please, there's no need for all this fighting and messing and playing around. There's no need for that. Come with me. I will buy you all a burger and a nice drink in the restaurant next door instead. So they took all the kids in, right? There were many of them. I don't know how many there was, 5 or 6 kids or something. Took them all in, brought them all the nice burger, brought them a nice drink. And then everybody was so happy. Everybody was smiling, right? And everybody was friends again. And what a beautiful way of resolving a difficult situation. A situation where you feel a bit, see, there's a tiny, tiny little Thai lady, right? Very, very small. And these kids were kind of just as big as she was. Nothing much she can do. Instead of being frightened, instead of being intimidated, she uses her goodness of her heart to resolve the situation in a beautiful way. And she felt so happy about that afterwards. These are just some examples of how we can live the life of a Buddhist in a powerful way that leads to so much happiness for ourselves and also so much happiness for the people around us. So that is just a little bit about generosity. There is much more, of course, to the idea of sila than generosity. It's about kindness in general. I think you can maybe summarize the idea of sila in one word, and that one word would be kindness. Another incident, and this is more about kindness than generosity, which I remembered this morning. I was sitting in my room, and this memory came up, and this was a story that I heard from somebody else. This was a story about my teacher, Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Brahm doesn't tell these kind of stories. You have to hear it secondhand. But this was a story from India. And Ajahn Brahm was doing this pilgrimage in India, and they were walking around. And I'm sure many of you here have been on a pilgrimage to India, and you know what it's like. All the beggars, right, always running after you. And if you are a monk, it doesn't make any difference. They run after you as well. If you tell them that you have no money, they don't believe you anyway, so they still run after you. So it is very hard to get rid of these beggars, right? You're scratching your head. How can I kind of, what can I do? I'm getting fed up with these beggars. That's sometimes how you feel. Perhaps you shouldn't feel like that. Still, that's sometimes how you feel. So Ajahn Brahm, the same thing happened to him, right? He was walking down, and this beggar was following him along. Ajahn Brahm is the only person I have heard of who was able to get rid of that beggar. So how do you get rid of a beggar like that? Of course, Ajahn Brahm didn't have any money. He didn't have anything except for his robe. There was nothing he could give away. So what did he do? And this was one of those spontaneous acts of kindness. It's not the kind of act that you can think out beforehand. It's the kind of act that happens spontaneously on the spur of the moment because you understand what is required. And he understood that this poor beggar boy probably has a very difficult life, right? Very hard life. They have probably been inducted into this gang, right? Begging for somebody else, having to give up all their money, may not have any parents. Often they are orphans, right? Very, very difficult life. So what Ajahn Brahm did, he took this poor beggar, picked him up, and gave him a big hug. That's what Ajahn Brahm did. And of course, the beggar boy, he was just smiling from ear to ear. It probably never happened to him before that somebody picks him up and gives him a big hug, right? He was so happy. And of course, then he let Ajahn Brahm go and did not ask him for any more money after that. That is the only way I've ever heard of getting rid of those beggars. So try that next time you go to India. See if that works. Check it out. Give the beggar a big hug instead. But it only really works if you do it spontaneously, right? Because then it feels real. The beggar could feel this is a real caring person. It's not just an act. It's not just playing. It's the real thing. So these are some of the acts of kindness and how often, if it is done spontaneously, if it is done on the spur of the moment, how it becomes very powerful and very useful. And it's something that gets locked into our mind and that we can tap into when it comes to the meditation practice itself. So this is, so please think like that. How can I be more kind to the people around me? How can I be more kind to myself? These are just two sides of the same coin. Being kind to yourself is being kind to others. Being kind to others is being kind to yourself. You cannot really split these things apart if you do it in a spiritual way. So that is a little bit about sila. We still have a few minutes left, so maybe I can talk a little bit more about sila. One of the most difficult aspects of sila is how to deal with the mind, right? The mind is so fast. Before you know it, you have an instant, you feel a bit upset about something, you feel a bit irritated. Before you know it, you have perhaps said even the wrong thing as a consequence of your thinking mind. So how do we deal with other people in the world so that we don't get angry, so that we don't get upset? This is one of those very, very difficult things that everybody really needs to reflect a little bit about. And I will give you one strategy today how to deal with other people so that it actually lessens your animosity, your anger and your irritation. Unless we do this, unless we actually actively try to counteract the anger and the way we perceive the people around us, we will never be able to get rid of those problems inside of us. If you don't get rid of those problems inside of you, it will come out in your speech, it will come out in your actions. Ultimately, we have to deal with the mind. So how do we deal with people around us? How do we think? How can we think in such a way that anger doesn't arise when people do stupid things? And there's always going to be people who do stupid things, right? There's always going to be people who do irritating things. Such is the world. The world will always have to be like that. So the solution is not to avoid those people. It cannot be done. You will have to deal with such people. So if you can't avoid them, what you have to do is learn to look at those people in a new way. And the way that I would recommend you to look at other people in the world is always to remember that no matter how stupid they are, no matter how angry they are, no matter how unfairly they treat you, no matter what it is, it always has the same reason why they act the way they do. The reason they act the way they do is because they have been conditioned into that, right? It's not an act of choice. They're not thinking, I want to do this bad thing, or I want to be stupid, or I want to be silly. That's not how it works. The way it works is because they have been conditioned like this through all the upbringing in this life, all the people they have met in this life, everything that has happened to them throughout these years in this life. And then on top of that, all the conditioning from past lives as well, right? All of this conditioning comes together in the here and now and causes that person to do what they're doing. They may not even want to do it. Very often we don't want to do these things, right? Have you noticed that in yourself sometimes? You don't want to say something bad or you don't want to do the wrong thing, but it's almost like you can't stop yourself. Right? And that's literally what it is. Every time you do something which is wrong, even though I'm sure everyone here knows it is much better to live a good and moral and kind life, even though you know that, you can't help yourself. The reason you can't help yourself is because the conditioning is so incredibly powerful. Everything we are as people is the conditioning that we have received from the past. We are in many ways like robots. We are robots running on a program that was written a long, long time in the past, probably in the past life. It doesn't feel like that. It feels like we have a sense of choice, a sense of free will. But the more clearly you understand yourself, the more clearly you understand how you act and how you live, the more obvious it becomes that you are incredible. Almost everything you do comes from causes and conditions in the past. Right? So when somebody does the wrong thing, remember you are not the victim. Or maybe you are a little bit of the victim, but they are much more the victim. They are a victim of their own conditioning. Even though they probably know it's better to be kind. We all know it's better to be kind, right? It feels right to be kind. It feels good. We know that's the right thing. Even though they are aware, even though they know that kindness is better, they can't stop themselves. They still have to do it, right? They are a victim of their own conditioning. Now that is a very powerful thought. When you remember that the people around you are the victim of their own conditioning, you are too, right? You're not accepted from that either. Everybody is a victim of their own conditioning. When you remember that, you can have compassion. Instead of feeling, oh, they are hurting me. This is unfair. This is unreasonable. Remember that actually they don't really want to hurt you. They are the victim of their own conditioning. Instead of thinking about yourself, turn it around and look at the other person instead. It is so painful. It is so difficult to always think about ourselves, right? To be selfish is such a painful and limited state of mind. So don't think about yourself. Think about the other person instead. And remember compassion. Remember kindness by knowing how conditioned they are. And to give you a simile that I often use to explain how this works. And this is, a human being is like a ship on the ocean. Right? A ship on the ocean which doesn't have any rudder, that doesn't have a wheel so you can steer it. There's no steering mechanism. Now, a ship on the ocean where there's no steering mechanism, what happens to that ship? What happens to that ship is that it drifts off into whatever the prevailing conditions are. If the wind comes from the north, the ship goes to the south. If the wind comes from the east, the ship goes to the west. If the current takes you from the west, the ship goes to the east, right? So all these conditions in the ocean, that is what makes that ship move in a certain direction. And it's exactly the same thing with people. Depending on the conditions in a person's life, you go this way. Depending on the conditions, you go the other way, right? It feels like we are in charge, but actually, we're not really in charge at all. This is part of this very profound Buddhist understanding of anatta, non-self. We are subjects. We are puppets, robots, running on a program that was written in the past. So please remember that, and then forgiveness becomes possible, right? Then forgiveness, in fact, becomes almost obligatory. How can you not forgive somebody who is running on a program written in the past? It's a bit like coming to a red traffic light, right? You come to a red traffic light. Now, if you want to, you can become angry at the traffic light. I am in a hurry. I need to go. And you are becoming red. Why on earth are you becoming red? I need to get to this place. I mean, you should know I'm in a hurry. And you can get out of your car and you can give that traffic light a good shake because you're so angry. But that's madness, right? It's absolutely crazy. I'm sure some people do it because sometimes people lose it completely. But remember, the traffic light and people are the same thing. Sometimes people go red, right? They go red with anger, quite literally. Sometimes people go red. But when people go red, then there's no reason to react back because that's what people do, just like traffic lights. And sometimes people go green and then you want to give them a hug because they're going green. Oh, what a wonderful person you are. And you want to be just like the traffic light. But again, it is not really they. Then you can rejoice in that good quality. But that too is in the end conditioned. But then at least you can rejoice in that. So that is a very simple strategy for how to deal with difficult situations in life. Remember that all these strategies, all these things that we teach in Buddhism, they may seem obvious. You know, when I say it now, perhaps you think, yeah, that makes sense. Perhaps you can relate to what I'm saying. Perhaps you don't. I don't know. But perhaps you do. But even though it makes sense right now, right here, it doesn't mean that it is easy to put into practice. Once you go into ordinary life, you forget about it, and then you can't bring it up at the right time, and it's difficult to do. All of these things make it much more harder. So it's something you have to do again and again and again. And with practice, given time, doing it again and again and again over time, gradually you start to understand these things in a deeper way. And the more deeply these teachings sink into your heart, right? Remember reflecting on these things. The deeper they sink into your heart, the more permanent part they become of your personality, the more permanent a part they become of your habits, the more permanent a part they become of who you actually are. And then when they become a part of you, then it becomes easy. Then it becomes natural. In the meantime, it takes work. Okay, so that is a little bit of a talk on meditation and some of the things that support meditation in life. So please continue to do a bit of meditation. It can be a very powerful thing here. Use meditation in your daily life not to gain profound states or deep samadhi or lots of insight. That is almost impossible in daily life. Use it to feel more at ease. Use it to feel relaxed. Use it to make you a better person. Do a bit of metta. Remember the goodness and the kindness in the community around you. When you remember the goodness and kindness in the community around you, you create a very strong bonds in the Buddhist community, and we become better friends, and we have more metta and more time for each other. If you use your meditation wisely, you don't have to meditate much. Even if you haven't got much time, if you can do 5 or 10 minutes every day, that's often enough to give you a little bit of extra energy, extra peace, extra metta for the world to sustain you and to keep you going in your daily life. Thank you. And now, Bhante, we are going to have a... It's a tea break, is that right? So now we have a tea break, I believe, and then after the tea break, in half an hour's time, we come back and we have some Q&A and discussion and that sort of thing here. Okay, very good. Okay, see you later on.
Friends, please be seated until Bhante leaves the hall. You're then invited to partake of tea and refreshments outside. And if you do have any questions which you'd like to pose to Bhante, you're more than welcome to note them down on a bit of paper at the entrance outside with Dilhara. And we will pass them on to Bhante, who will take all your questions soon after the tea break. We'd like to have you all back in your seats in exactly 15 minutes. Thank you very much.